You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. Many of you, and I'm sure if we got a chance to meet one-on-one and then went through perhaps your basement, your garage, we would find maybe things such as your vinyl records, tape players, even a landline still connected to the wall, something that we all, especially those of us who are part of the baby boomer generation, grew up with, things that for most people today seem somewhat obsolete, and I suppose they are. But many people hold on to those things. But more importantly, where did all of this start? Now, many of you may believe that it's probably started in the 50s or the 60s. Well, my guest this week is best-selling author John Farrell, and his new book is The Clock and the Camshaft and Other Medieval Inventions We Still Can't Live Without. And John's research has really uncovered some amazing information regarding that some of the things that we have taken for granted, some of the things we have lived with for so many years, had its origins in medieval times, and to this day are still pretty relevant. Hey, John, nice to have you with us.
So glad to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
This you must have felt like I did, that, you know, okay, since I grew up, as I said, I had my vinyl records, I had my my tape deck in my car, my landline, and those are just small examples, but so much of what we know of, especially people growing up in the 50s and the 60s, and even through the 70s and 80s, much of that because of technology and advancements is no longer relevant. But what I found most amazing in reading your book was that many inventions had origins in medieval times, right?
Oh, yes, exactly, yeah. You know, eyeglasses, the mechanical clock, and a lot of social inventions we sort of take for granted as well, definitely.
John, was that a... You know, obviously we weren't around, so we can't verify that. But I'm sure through historical documentation and the research that you did, I'm going to assume that medieval times was a prolific time for inventions and for ingenuity and looking for the next best invention. What was that, a period where people were really hepped up on finding new ways and bettering one's life?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah, and. It was kind of aided and abetted by the fact that the climate in the Middle Ages, the late 700s through maybe the 1300s, was a lot milder, so that that kind of gave them a break in terms of improving their technology without, you know, worrying too much about freezing to death or, you know, unpredictable climate, although it did change toward the end of the Middle Ages. And in fact, you could probably say, you know, the Black Death was kind of like the bookmark of the end of the Middle Ages in terms of the climate and disease and so forth. But to your point, yes, over the centuries, basically what you had was, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, everyday people, and we don't know their names, they're lost to history, they kind of carried on through all of the mayhem invasions into Europe from all the kind of the populations moving west and causing a lot of havoc at the higher level. But at the basic level, everyday people were trying to figure out, okay, we need to eat, we need to clothe ourselves. And they kind of picked up the pieces of what was left over from the Roman Empire, specifically milling technology, water wheels, horizontal mills, vertical mills, mostly at the start, obviously, just to grind grain so they could feed themselves. But as they began to kind of piece together different things, they realized they could improve a basic technology and use it for just about anything else, making clothing, making weapons, cutting wood, fulling cloth. And all of this was just kind of an approach of like, well, what else can we do with this, you know, to make life better? It wasn't something they wrote out on a constitution, but it was just very much their attitude. And a lot of those things are basically still with us. Now, the clock, of course, is actually really a standout invention that is kind of amazing in the fact that they didn't have, you know, we all went to high school math and physics and so forth. They had no textbook principles of dynamics. They didn't have Newton. They didn't have anything to tell them how gravity works. They just had their intuition and the work of their hands and all of the knowledge they would pass on from generation to generation vocally, you know. And they figured out a problem that just had huge ramifications for not just European Middle Ages, but, you know, down through the ages up to the present day. I mean, we all live by our clocks. You know, sometimes we curse the fact that we have to live by our clocks. But the quantification of time with the mechanical clock in the Middle Ages was like just a work of fantastic genius. And it was probably a group effort. They think it was probably a team of blacksmiths working with millwrights. And their initial problem was not actually to make a clock to tell time for the sake of time, but rather to figure out a way to automate the ringing of church bells for a bishop or for a monastery, because, you know, you had all these monks who had to get up at all hours of the night to remind people when it's time to get up and do midnight prayers, go back to sleep, get up at 5 and do prayers at dawn. And instead of having, you know, some poor guy have to do the duty of staying up all night, they wanted a way to automate it. And the fantastic breakthrough with the clock was that they already knew how to use water power. You know, they had mills for, you know, doing all these things that I mentioned, and they knew how to use wind power, you know, with the windmills and stuff. But then they thought, well, what about gravity? Can we exploit gravity? Because everybody knows what gravity is. You know, we've all fallen down and hurt ourselves, and there it is. And they must have figured out, but I think what's fantastic about it, it was kind of a reverse application. In other words, it's like, well, instead of using, you know, water power to drive something, how can we use gravity to inertia to inhibit something? Because if you just, you know, hook up an axle with a weight, it's just going to plummet and spin to the floor. So to make the clock, they had to think of a way, build a device, an escapement drive is what it's called, the Virgin Foliot, that would allow the weight, the power to be used and exploited for like 12 hours and more at a time. And it's really ingenious when you think about, again, nobody knew what inertia was the way we, you know, learned in high school class, but they knew what it was just from their experience. And I imagine it must have taken a lot of trial and error, you know, sitting down at night with a beer with the guys afterwards and saying, okay, well, those weights were too heavy, that didn't work, let's try something else, or, you know, and then came up with this device at the towards the end of the 1200s. And then as soon as it worked, it took off all across Europe. Like within a century, I think by the end of the 1300s, like the King of France was able to come up with a standard time for the whole country, because now you had clocks in all of the church towers and all the cities. And not only, you know, were you able to standardize time, which had all sorts of economic ramifications, because now merchants and sellers could be like, you know, oh, we have work days and we can quantify everything. The quantification of time also had huge ramifications, you know, down the road in a couple of centuries, for Copernicus and Galileo and Newton when the scientific revolution took off. Because, you know, if you can't quantify time, you can't do any kind of, you know, equations of motion or equations of, you know, astronomy and so forth. So it was, again, an invention that was done for kind of a particular narrow reason. Let's ring some church bells.
Right.
Ends up, like, transforming the entire civilization, like, down to this day.
Well, you know, and it comes down, as I was reading through the book, a couple of things that came to light. One is, I think a lot of people may believe that it was one particular region of the world, perhaps Europe, medieval Europe, where many of these inventions, but you touch upon the fact that, you know, there was contributions from the Middle East, from Asia, yes, indeed, certainly from Europe. But again, going back to the clock, because it's, you know, time has been, and you're right, even to this very day, we live by the clock, whether you're in the United States or any other part of the world. It just seems that that's, you know, those 24 hours, 7 days a week, we live our lives by that. So the inventions were premised on the fact that we need this because we live day to day, we live by certain times, and we need to know where we are and how can we do this better. So what I'm getting at is necessity was really the underlying theme, right?
Oh, exactly. And to your point, it's kind of amazing because you think, you know, well, in those days nobody had airplanes or trains. You know, how did this technology appear to pass back and forth between East and West,
right,
so relatively quickly? But it obviously did. I mean, there are some things that were probably independently invented at the same time. For example, the camshaft. It looks like it was being used in China in the early centuries of the Common Era for hauling rice. But now they found some evidence that in Spain, Roman Spain, the empire, they were also using camshafts to drive trip hammers so that they could pound ore, you know, for making weapons. So
right.
But other things, you know, like windmill technology, probably started in Persia and then kind of migrated into Europe, where, again, they kind of adapted it and improved it for their own purposes. But it's amazing to think, like, well, you know, somebody had to schlep that on foot.
Exactly. And that's what impressed me the most, is that at a time today, we take it sometimes for granted that we've got the aid of technology and with so much more the resources that we have available. They didn't have any of that. It was strictly out of, hey, you know what? This is making life difficult. Perhaps if I could just come up with an idea. I know that sounds very rudimentary, but I think that's how it all worked. I want to take just a quick pause to remind folks that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is best-selling author John Farrell. His new book is The Clock and the Camshaft. And if you have, you still have a landline like I do, and if you still have your LPs and your tape decks and some of the things that you've grown up with and become so comfortable with, John's book sheds light on the fact that much of what we today take for granted or what we've been using for decades really had its roots in medieval times. And as we've been talking about the necessity of making life a little bit easier. And John, you know, you've alluded to it. There were no technical schools. It wasn't like, well, you can go to MIT, and once you graduate from there, someone's bound to come up with an idea. I mean, these were just basic people who lived an agrarian lifestyle, right?
Oh, exactly, yeah. And for so long, I think, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, I mean, there were no cities. There was nothing. I think in the book I referenced, and of course, you know, scholars have to kind of, you know, do some amount of guesswork, but they figure the population at the height of the Roman Empire was about 67 million, and by the 700s, after the collapse of Rome, it had dropped to like 27 million. So there must have been a lot of death and carnage, you know, before people kind of picked themselves back up and started, you know, getting back to work.
The other thing that I found interesting is, I don't want to make this sound sexist, but women also, I mean, people think, well, back then, you know, all women did was take care for the children, cook the meals, and, you know, keep the home base clean. But you even allude to the fact that women, men, equally shared in moving forward many of these novel ideas, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Especially at the level of running the mills, ale houses, anything to do with entrepreneurial business, the women were as much in the leadership roles as the men were. At a higher level, in terms of intellectual, not so much. In fact, it's kind of it's probably one of the one aspects of that period that is not as happy as it should be, where women were kind of excluded from education, you know, as the universities became invented,
right,
and grew. You had kind of a retraction in terms of what the opportunities for women who were interested in reading and doing that kind of thing. And in fact, if you wanted to be an intellectual woman, the only way you could do that is, like, well, become a nun, you know, move into a convent, and
right,
you can avoid marriage. But but to your immediate point, in terms of the everyday business of living, you know, the lay people running the mills, the blacksmiths, and all those different kind of parts of business, women were very much involved alongside the men. I don't think they thought twice about that. Definitely.
Wow. Interesting. The subtitle of the book is really what I want to focus on for a minute. And other medieval inventions we still can't live without. So in other words, the connotation there is that things that are still in vogue today, perhaps not in the same form, obviously, but had its origins there. But give me just some examples. I know we talked about the clock, as time is, time is something that everybody, unfortunately, lives by. But what other things are basically still part and parcel of our everyday lives today that had their origins back then?
Well, one thing I have to put on every day as soon as I get up is a pair of glasses. I don't know about you. But,
oh, yeah.
And those two were invented around the 1200s, and it's kind of funny. It's almost like something you'd see in a Monty Python movie, the evolution of glasses, because you had these, you know, poor monks in the monasteries, the older guys, finding it, you know, their vision going, and it's like, well, what can we do? And they were operating out of, like, you know, they were filling glass balls with water as magnifying glasses, and you'd have to roll it across the page to read. Imagine you wouldn't get a lot of reading done having to do that.
No, I wouldn't think so.
But basically what you had, a couple of key things. One is during the Crusades, when the soldiers were coming back, they basically discovered rock crystals when they were over in the Middle East. The crystal makers, the glass makers, seized on that because they realized, oh, this glass is a lot better than kind of the natural stuff we have here. We can grind them and make better lenses. And then you had an additional discovery, again, probably brought back from the Middle East, either by crusaders or merchants. They discovered natron, which is a kind of a mineral salt in Cairo, and you could use that with lime to improve glass quality. It basically allowed glass to liquefy at lower temperatures and in more pure form. So suddenly now you can make better glass to see through, magnification. And then the final step was figuring out, well, this is great, but instead of having to hold a magnifying glass or a glass, is there a way to, like, you know, create spectacles you can just wear on your nose? And that was, again, they figured out if you just blew a huge crystal ball and symmetrically sliced off chunks of it from either side, you could basically come up with identical lenses. That way you're not, like, making glasses
right,
that have,
right.
You know, one lens is too good and the other lens is throwing you off. so that happened, again, in the late 1200s. And again, it took off pretty quick. You actually had a Venetian guild of spectacle makers by the early 1300s. And by the later 1300s, Britain was importing, you know, spectacles at the rate of like 400 a month. So everybody obviously realized this is great. Let's buy it. You know, it just took off right away.
And throughout the book, you talk about how obviously the underlying theme was here, necessity, making life easier. And I think that's still pretty much, the tempo today, too. But I hear so much, you've heard this term yourself, we're a throwaway society. What's in vogue last year, it's maybe outdated,
right.
Throw it away. I think we had I'm going back perhaps decades now in timing myself, but I think people held on to these new inventions longer than seeing the mastery of it. And yes, certainly there were advancements of it, but today we're such a hurry to what was newly discovered perhaps a year or two ago, especially as it relates to technology, is thrown out the window for something that's supposed to be superior, and I'm not always sure that it really is. Is that just because, you know, society has just moved on? Because, like I said, through your book, I get the sense that once they came upon these things, they were in use for decades or even centuries, or am I missing something here?
No, you're exactly true. In fact, to your point, I still gripe to my kids that, do you remember, it was called a flip video. This is before iPhones had their cameras, and you bought it. It looked like an iPhone. It was fantastic quality video you could carry around in your pocket. And it was obsolete, like, just a few years after I bought it. And it really annoyed me because I thought, you come up with a great device, and then for market reasons or whatever, it's like, okay, we're going to forget this now and just move the thing into the iPhone. And, of course, it's great quality, the video quality in iPhone. But I remember just kind of really being annoyed by, like, I feel like I was just getting used to this thing, and then it just disappeared from the marketplace altogether.
Yeah. with that said, then, let me ask you, was the mindset of those early discoveries that people used for many, many years without the thought of, well, you know, we can better this. Next year we'll come out with something new, better eyeglasses. And as I said, I'm sure there were advancements. But are we likely to rush to judgment today and say, well, nope, we can do even better and sometimes bring something to market that may not even be perfected? Because I get the sense that, yeah, okay, they introduced these things and maybe they weren't 100%, but they did make people's lives better. They did enhance people's lives. And over time, there were revisions and there were advancements. I just get the sense that there's less appreciation today as new things come on the market, even though they supposedly make our lives easier and that people had a better sense of that decades or even centuries ago.
Yes. In fact, kind of to our previous discussion about eyeglasses. They took off so well. You had a case where by like the 1400s or the 1500s, they were so common, the quality was starting to go down, which is kind of, you know, probably a first at that time period, to the point where when Galileo wanted to create his telescope, the store-bought lenses were just, you know, he just said, these are lousy, and he ended up grinding his own lenses. So you can actually see an example of a deterioration of quality in, like, a necessity item, even in the Middle Ages, the later Middle Ages, before it kind of got better again. Again, probably because they got used to kind of mass-producing something rather than, you know, hand-crafting it. And I think that's very much a problem which, you know, we have to deal with today.
That's a great point. Some people, not all, some people really, whether it's jewelry, clothing, you know, something that a person with real talent took time to make one of or two of, put their heart and soul into it. And it delivered not only enjoyment for the end user, but had years and years of good service. Where today is everything's mass produced. Now, obviously, in medieval times, that was probably not even on the agenda. Thinking that, well, geez, now that I've kind of come up with this idea of eyeglasses, let's produce 100,000 of them and we'll sell them at Walmart. That wasn't the case. I guess what I'm asking is, are we sometimes not really better off because we rush so many things to market and they need so much in the way of adjustments let's bring back the idea and we'll revamp this and we'll come up with another edition next year. Are we less likely to be appreciative of some of the things that that people back then didn't take advantage of?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And of course, I think you also have the motivation of companies that realize that there's more money in just requiring you and me to have to buy a new washing machine every 10 years rather than making, like, this monster that'll last for 50 years and we'll just supply, you know, the high-quality parts as you need them. So there's kind of a, I don't want to say sinister, but you know what I mean? There's a drive there in terms of making money that kind of comes at our expense.
Right.
And again, I'm dating myself. You were talking about like the things that you still have. I still have the Electrolux my parents bought when they got married in 1949, still works.
Yep, I hear you. I've got a little portable TV bought 1981. Everything's flat screen today. That thing has a better picture and better quality. It's, you know, it goes right on than anything else. So it sounds as if that today we've been groomed to think that what's in vogue today either should be discarded next year or there should be a new and improved item going forward. More importantly, and I'm always curious about this with authors, regardless of what they're writing about. Why this topic? How did this all come about? I'm sure you didn't sit there one Sunday thinking, "Hey, you know what? I'm thinking about the things that I still use today, and why don't I write a book about the origins of some of these inventions and how they still, still part and parcel of our life." What motivated you to write this book?
I kind of tortuously backstepped my way into it after my first book, which was kind of a science bio of the Catholic priests who came up with the first version of the Big Bang Theory in the 1930s. And I was researching his life and kind of, you know, reading about the history of science, you know, because he was friends with Einstein and he was really into general relativity. And so I had to, like, kind of go into the history of, you know, the physics before he came along. That kind of pointed me backwards. I mean, you know, we're all kind of taught about Newton and Copernicus and Galileo. The kind of intellectual breakthroughs that, you know, particular human beings made to contribute to, like, the history of science. But as I was reading it, I realized that every time I kind of went further and further back, it's like, well, they had clocks, you know. And then I kept going further back. It's like, well, where did the clock come from? And I stumbled upon, it was an essay written by an historian of science not so much about the clock, but just about that period in the Middle Ages, which I hadn't really thought about it. But he wasn't actually like writing a book about it. It was like an essay in a collection about lots of other things. But it was just something I happened to read, and it kind of stuck in the back of my mind because I was going through, and there were some inaccuracies of it because, you know, in all fields of scholarship, people are always revising things or discovering new things. And he was probably a little bit more... kind of gung-ho about what was invented just in the Middle Ages as opposed to what actually was invented by the Romans, but then perfected by, the people in the Middle Ages. So it was a little dated. But I just kept that in the back of my mind because I thought, oh, that's a kind of cool idea. I wonder if there would be a book there. Yeah. And that's basically what happened after my first book. I just kind of pitched the idea to my agent, and she said, yeah, it sounds pretty cool. Why don't you come up with a proposal? And that's basically how it worked. But I feel like I kind of backed into it. It wasn't because I had an aha moment.
Well, but you know what, John? It's I'm glad you wrote the book. Not just saying that. One, obviously, folks know that I'm somewhat of a history buff. But more importantly, it points out that, people think, oh, geez, the Middle East, what could they possibly, life must have been horrible. No, they probably didn't have warm running water in their house 24/7. And no, they didn't have boilers and furnaces to keep them warm in winter times. But the fact of the matter is, back then, and it was a very, from reading your book, a very prolific era in terms of coming up with these novel ideas that made one's life easier. And the mere fact, as you said, that much of what we use today still has its basis in those original inventions. So it's pretty terrific. If people want to get more information, obviously the book is going to be released this week, The Clock and the Camshaft. But if people just want to Google and get more information about you and your research, how might they do that, John?
Let me see. I'm on Twitter, John W. Farrell at Twitter, which is easy, and that has a link to my website. But my website is just basically my last name with media.com, so Farrell Media, FarrellMedia.com. And I have links to my, my articles and my books and some of the other media that I produce there. And the audiobook just came out a couple of months ago, so because I love listening to audiobooks. One technology I hope doesn't become disposable
right.
too soon. So that's on Amazon, and you can get the book at Barnes & Noble. That's also on Amazon and Bookshop. And let me see where else. Yeah, Audible is, part of Amazon, so you can find that there.
And John, I also want to just throw in real quick. John is in the Boston area, so he is a local guy. So it's always, to me personally, it's always nice to have, a local author, someone that we can basically drive down to the Boston area and if need be, and meet face to face. So this is really great. John, one last question, because I thought about this and I said, yeah, I got to ask him this. Of all the things that you research, and we talked about eyeglasses, we talked about clocks. We talked about so many things that had their origins around the world, but specifically in the medieval times. What do you find of all that research that you actually use today that you can honestly say, thank God back then somebody had the wherewithal to create that, because I'm still using a version of that today, and I can't see myself not having that at my disposal.
That's true, yeah. But besides clocks and glasses, which I desperately rely on, I'd have to say the universities. Both my daughters are at universities now, and it's surprising that the universities were kind of not a deliberate invention, but kind of an indirect benefit of what was a more deliberate invention, and that happened in the Middle Ages. And not just the universities, but the whole kind of legal structure that allowed the universities to come into being also allowed the creation of guilds, which, the forefathers of labor unions. And so they're like a social invention that, again, all of us can't live without. I mean, it's hard to imagine, life without higher education for people, and not just, we think of universities, but of course high schools are kind of the carbon copy.
Right.
And that too was an invention of the Middle Ages. We just have to depend on that to, keep. We can't just rely on, granddad teaching us how to do everything.
Exactly.
It has to be kind of institutionalized, and that too was kind of a creation of 11th and 12th centuries.
And you're so right. I mean, you just think, and I think just, you know, obviously we have busy schedules in our lives and not everybody's going to say, well, Al, what are you talking about? But, you know, just taking a moment to think about, you know what, the things that we take for granted, the things that we think were always here, weren't always here. Somebody had the wherewithal, somebody had the foresight to come up with these ideas. And that's what I found so enjoyable about reading John's book, The Clock and the Camshaft. Again, my guest this evening has been the author of The Clock and the Camshaft, John Farrell. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.